treating companion animals not just with love, but with respect.
I work in the book. I mean, I'm telling a story here, so this is really all about a story. And I look at what is the difference between being a teacher of someone, whether canine or human, but in this case, canine. What does it mean to be a teacher when you are empowering a dog to be the best they can possibly be? You are empowering a dog to live within sets of rules, just like anyone does, as opposed to training a dog or conditioning a dog through nothing but obedience.
That's Ellen Cooney. We talk with her about her newest novel, The Mountaintop School for Dogs. We also replay our conversation with animal behaviorist Vint Verga about his book, The Soul of All Living Creatures. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I used to live next to a family who kept their dog chained in their yard all day long, every day. My neighbors were nice, friendly people. But their dog, a yellow lab mix with a sweet disposition, was terribly lonely and neglected. It tore my heart out to see her out in the yard day after day in all kinds of weather. Finally, after asking the owner's permission, I started taking her for walks. The dog's enforced confinement was so extreme and her need for exercise so unmet that she was a real handful on walks, straining desperately at the leash so as not to miss one iota of the wider world that was normally denied her. Eventually it became too much of a chore for me, and I did it less and less, feeling guilty every time I saw her. We use the word humane to describe behavior that's compassionate and caring, but sometimes I wonder, maybe we should use something like canine instead, or yes, even feline, because can we really hold up humans as exemplars of such behavior? Maybe we need to act more like our companion animals act toward us. And if more of us treated them as well as they treat us, we'd have a lot fewer traumatized, abused, and neglected animals. We also might have fewer traumatized, abused, and neglected humans. My guest Ellen Cooney ponders these questions in her new work of fiction, The Mountaintop School for Dogs and Other Second Chances. Wrapped within a kind of mystery novel is an exploration of our relationship to the animals who share our lives. What happens when things go wrong, either through evil intent or even just simple misunderstanding? Cooney's protagonist is a young woman who's been through some traumas of her own. Answering a mysterious ad in the paper, she finds herself in the midst of a unique rescue operation for abused animals. What she learns there not only changes the lives of the animals she's come to help, but her life as well. Ellen Cooney is the author of numerous previous novels, including Lumbrusco, which we spoke with her about in 2008. She lives in Maine with her canine companions. I spoke with her this fall, just after the dog belonging to a Spanish nurse who was treated for Ebola was put to sleep because of fears that the dog would transmit the disease. Well, Ellen Cooney, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
You know, we're doing this interview just a day after I heard news that just profoundly upset me. Your book, The Mountaintop School for Dogs, is about, at heart, a rescue operation, and that's the plot. It's a school, it's a refuge for dogs that's involved with a kind of underground railroad rescue, and we are talking a day after a dog named Excalibur was put to death in Spain because his owner has Ebola.
Yes.
And I can't tell you how much this upset me.
Upsetting, yes. Tell me, Francesca, which part of it first began to upset you when you heard the news? What was the thing that hit you the hardest about that?
That they didn't even try to monitor the dog. That there's no proof ever that a dog has infected a human.
Right.
That the dog was safe and cared for by the nurse's husband.
Yes.
That there was absolutely no reason to do this.
In the minds of many people, there would have been a reason. And the reason was that dog might be a threat. That dog has no rights in the world like we human beings do, because we're human and we make the decisions. So therefore, we're going to kill that dog so that we feel more comfortable about something. Think about all the dogs that are killed by police. If a dog gets out of its yard and it's running down the street and somebody calls a cop in certain parts of the country, there's a very good chance that dog is automatically going to get shot. With Excalibur, the terrible, terrible thing about it is he never had a chance. He was automatically put up there as, okay, we need to feel that we're doing something about this threat, so let's kill the dog. It's tremendously, terribly upsetting. And I dealt with a lot of that kind of stuff in this book, in this novel. People who do things to animals that absolutely are baffling, but it's not baffling to the people who are doing it. For example, people who keep their dogs tied up outside on a chain all the time.
Yes, yeah. I've seen that. I've seen that so many times. Why do they have a dog, I wonder?
Well, they have a dog because in their minds, what needs to happen with the dog that they have is to put a chain on the dog and attach the chain to a stake, and the dog is in the yard protecting the house or whatever they're thinking. But the thinking is, we are the human beings, and so we get to make the decision about the dog. What we say goes. When I was writing the novel, I made a decision not to show any of the abuse that the animals went through. You can go online and find out all kinds of stuff like that. I wanted no graphic violence. I wanted no violence in my novel, and that was a decision I made because we can't do anything to stop violence, but we can do something about its aftermath. So what I wanted to do with the dog characters in my book, and with the people too, because they're also rescues, is to show them in various states of getting healed from being abused. So in a way, this is really a rehab novel.
And let's talk about the characters in the novel. So tell us about Evie. She is your main character in this novel, a 24-year-old who was in rehab and applies for a job. Tell us about the job. Tell us about the place.
The job is to become a dog trainer. And the place is the top of a mountain. I never say where the mountain is. And the sanctuary is an animal refuge place on top of the mountain. It's a former ski resort, and it's run by a group of elderly women. So Evie applies to a dog training program run by the sanctuary, but first she has to put in some probationary time at an inn at the bottom of the mountain that's run by a 50-year-old woman who is not your usual genial, outgoing, affable innkeeper, but is something of a porcupine of a woman, Mrs. Aubuchon, and she's the other main character.
Yeah, she doesn't think too highly of Evie at first.
She does not.
But then some things change her mind. Tell us more about Evie and how she begins to grow a little bit on Miss Aubuchon.
Well, what happens is Evie lied on her application because she said she had experience with dogs, and she doesn't. But she was desperate to find something to do with her life after what she's just coming out of. She's 24 years old, and she's youthful. She is impulsive. But she has a feeling that she might be able to work well with animals. She can't articulate it. She has a feeling she should go do this. And Mrs. Aubuchon sees her one day interacting with a really profoundly abused dog who's in rehab, and the dog is obsessive compulsive in a really serious way. And Evie, right off the top of her head, meeting this dog, just creatively comes up with a solution to begin to deal with the dog's serious psychological problems. And Evie does something with this dog totally creatively, totally impulsively, and it works. And Mrs. Aubuchon sees that she is truly gifted and talented at working with animals.
Yeah, she really is. I mean, I wonder if you could tell us what she does, because I just thought it was a lovely... You know, at first I was trying to figure out, we're looking from Miss Aubuchon's point of view, and like Miss Aubuchon, I'm trying to figure out what the heck is Evie doing?
Right. With Evie, she's a truly gifted teacher, and she's a teacher of animals. She has a connection. It's not sentimentalized. It's not like a dog whisperer kind of thing, for example. She imagines what's going on with a dog, and then she imagines a good way to interact. I think a lot of people, for example, who are special needs teachers have this ability, or any kind of healer. I think you have to have an element of creativity in interacting with the other person, and it's the kind of creativity you have to bring to, say, writing a novel. It's that same kind of impulse. And almost a daringness. I'm going to try this and I'm going to see what happens. And that's what Evie does.
So we'll leave the details to the reader.
Yes.
So you're talking, you make a point in the book at some point. You mention, and it may even be a chapter heading, I'm not sure, the difference between teaching and conditioning. And you mentioned the dog whisperer. I think of the controversy over Cesar Millan.
Yes.
And his ways of training dogs.
Yes.
I wonder if you could weigh in on this and tell us about the
difference.
I would
be happy to weigh in on that. The one thing my book does is to lay out a case against alpha, the whole alpha mentality, which is also laying out a case against patriarchy, if you will. We think about conditioning of dogs as, okay, you will do what I say, and everything is based on obedience and being the leader of the pack. Everything about my book is against that.
Say more about that.
So I work in the book, I'm telling a story here, so this is really all about a story. And I look at what is the difference between teaching, being a teacher of someone, whether canine or human, but in this case canine, what does it mean to be a teacher when you are empowering a dog to be the best they can possibly be? You are empowering a dog to be civilized, to live within sets of rules just like anyone does, as opposed to teaching a dog or training a dog or conditioning a dog through nothing but obedience, where the dog has to obey you no matter what, to the letter, or the dog is going to be punished in some way. There are still lots of trainers who believe in conditioning whereby the dog receives different kinds of punishment in order to get the right behavior going, the right behavior in the eyes of the human. And in this kind of thinking, the animal doesn't ever get to think for itself or make decisions for itself. In this other kind of teaching, the dog is encouraged to learn how to make his or her own decisions. It's the same thing with students or with children. With a child, there's so much talk now of corporal punishment. People who do corporal punishment, those of us who are appalled, look at that and say, how can you beat a 4-year-old child? And then we say, how can you beat your dog? How can you hit your dog? Your dog has done something you don't like, but to the dog, that's it. The dog didn't do anything bad, but the human thinks it was bad, and so the human is suddenly hitting the dog. Those kinds of things go on all the time because alpha goes on all the time, because dominance goes on all the time. And my book, in its own story way, in its own subversive, if you will, way is saying, excuse me, wait a second, let's look at that. Let's look at what empowerment means. And I think the case that gets laid out in my novel, it's not a case, you know, really, I emphasize, this is a story. But there are results. And the characters who are the human characters who are engaging with animals in this way of teaching actually end up having a wonderful time and literally getting lots and lots of good stuff back for it.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Ellen Cooney about her latest novel, The Mountaintop School for Dogs.
Yeah, when you, Cesar Millan, when you talk about Alpha, you know, his whole theory is that dogs, you know, we have to understand the dog culture, which is they run in packs and there are alpha dogs. Although actually recently I found out that that's not totally true. I mean, an alpha dog is not necessarily the alpha forever,
right.
You know. So I wonder if you could give us an example of the difference. Take any kind of common, say, so-called misbehavior on the part of a dog, something that makes the owners very uncomfortable. I don't know if this is something you can do, but how might somebody who was empowering a dog approach it as opposed to somebody who was, you know, we know Cesar Millan, you know, exactly how he would exercise his authority.
Okay, I can give you a perfect example. The trash can in your bathroom, okay? The dog, and I'm going through this right now with one of my rescues, is still young. She's not even 2 years old yet, but she lived in a cage in a shelter for her first 7 months of life. So she has a lot of learning to do. She believes that going into the bathroom wastebasket, which, by the way, I have a lid on, and I turn it around so that it's hard to get to it, she learned how to open the lid and how to turn the barrel around so she can get into the wastebasket. She believes that going into the wastebasket and dumping it all over the floor and chewing and even swallowing what's in that trash barrel, she thinks that's her purpose in life. She believes that she is doing a true great dog thing by chewing up my trash and putting it all over the floor. So I come in and I look at her again because I thought we already learned this lesson. And I look at her and I say to her, how could you do this? I thought you already learned that. And she looks at me like, why aren't you telling me how proud you are of me? Okay. So we have a difference of opinion. And if you look at it like that, it changes the whole situation. For example, one of my other dogs, we live near a beach and we walk on the beach every day. One of my dogs thinks that his purpose in life is to find dead fish rotting near the shoreline and roll in it so that he can stink of dead fish. He thinks this is his job. So when I say to him, please don't do that today, we are not seeing things from the same point of view. I have another dog who excessively barks. And if someone goes by the house, I live in a rural area, if someone goes by on their bicycle, he feels that he has to scream barking for half an hour because somebody went by. And I say, okay, that's enough barking. He does not agree with me. So you look at that rather, you don't look at that like you must obey my rules. You look at it as a difference of opinion, and you're saying to the dog, you know what, putting my bathroom trash on the floor is not okay. You can't eat dirty Kleenex. That's not okay. And so you keep saying, this is not okay, this is not okay. But in the situation of the dog rolling in the dead fish, I let that go. Okay? So you figure out what you can let go, which, I mean, that's not going to change. And it's really not bad. He just stinks. So that some people might say, oh, my God, I can't stand to have my dog stink like a dead fish. But why have a dog if the dog doesn't get to be a dog? So what if the dog stinks? So what if the dog, you know, wash the dog or don't wash the dog? I think what can happen a lot is that people want their dogs to act more like children or more like humans Whereas I'm saying in my book, I think that people should actually act more like dogs. I think that we shouldn't have the same behavior things for dogs that we have for humans. Now, there are other things that dogs do that are really, really, really wrong that you don't negotiate. And like, for example, biting and attacking other dogs. My little dog is going through a period of being unfriendly to strange dogs, and I'm working on that every second that she's outdoors with me, because that's not okay.
And how do you do that? I mean, how do you do that in a way that empowers her and is this non-alpha patriarchal
okay.
way of doing it?
I'll tell you what I'm doing with her. I'm going to laugh when I tell you this, but it's really working. One thing, well, first of all, we don't go in the dog. There's a dog park not far from my house, and two of my dogs are so happy in there. But my youngest, we sit outside the fence and watch other dogs play. And when she's walking with me, I'm still leash training her, I hold her very, very close to my body. And when another dog is coming by, I know she's going to try to attack because she's in this mode of trying to attack everything. And she has issues with her own ability to think. So what I do with her is I make her sit down. She sits down, and I pat her on the head while the other dog goes by, and I say to the person with the dog, please don't come too close. She's in training. She's not social yet. So that's what I do now. And then every day, here comes the part that I laugh about, I bring her into my writing room because she likes to be allowed in my writing room. It's a big treat for her. I subscribe to a lot of animals' websites, so there's always something churning up of a video with dogs in it. And so every day, Maxine, that's my dog, every day Maxine watches a dog video, okay? And she sits on my lap watching dog videos of stranger dogs. And I'm patting her and saying, oh, look at the nice dog. This is actually working.
That's great. She
loves these videos. And I notice that sometimes when she sees them, because there's 500 million dog videos online. And I notice that when there's videos of puppies, she is just happy, 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 happy. But then when there's a big dog, who, like, say, you know, a Rottweiler or, you know, a German Shepherd, she growls. And so I realized that this is a size issue, and I learned that about her. She's threatened by large dogs, even though she has one of her brothers is, you know, three times her size, but that's her brother. Mm. But she's scared of size, so that when I'm out walking with her now, I can let her try to say hello to dogs who are smaller than her, and that's what we're working on. As for the bathroom trash that she keeps getting into, I say no. I look at her and I say, no, you were bad. And that's starting to work because she looks at my facial expression, and this worked with one of my other dogs who I had to do this with. You look at your dog like, oh, my God, you just chewed up my dirty Kleenex. You have broken my heart. I'm just so unhappy. And they see that you're unhappy, and then you do this over and over, and sooner or later, that unhappiness is going to enter them. I promise. You just have to let it happen. Your unhappiness will enter them, and they will end up not going into the trash because they don't want to see that look on your face.
Well, I hope that works with cats, by the way.
I know absolutely nothing about cats.
Now, we started out this conversation, Ellen Cooney, talking about the terrible case of Excalibur.
Yes.
Your book, The Mountaintop School for Dogs, is a wonderful story, but also has a lot of really interesting information about abuse of dogs and kind of prompts the reader to think, to rethink some of their own ideas and prejudices. I wonder, what's your take on, should animals have legal rights, have civil rights in themselves?
Well, you know, I don't know what that means to have civil rights. You know, I don't know, because that puts everything in a legal perspective.
Well, let me ask, in your book, it features a kind of, you know, an underground railroad and a whole rescue operation.
Yes.
Do you think there should be laws, or maybe there already are, because I'm completely ignorant about this, but do you think people who are not dog owners should have the right to rescue abused dogs from owners who are abusing them?
Yes, I do. But is it a right or is it a moral obligation? You know, or are they the same things? The network, there's a this thing called the network, and they literally kidnap dogs who have been living their whole lives chained outside. If they can't help the dog in any other way, yes, I do. I think that victims of abuse, dogs, children, people, whatever, I think if you are defenseless and someone is hurting you, someone has power over you, you have no power, you have no defenses, someone is beating you or they're whatever, you have the right to get away from that. So I look at it that way. The person who's beating a dog every day does not have the right to beat that dog. The dog has the right to have a life without being beaten. That's how I look at it. In my book, there's this thing called the network, and they do kidnapping. And as it happened just a little while ago at one of the events I did at a bookstore reading, a woman approached me who loved my book and does, in fact, belong to an actual radical rescue group. And they are, I did interview others, so I didn't make this up. But this woman at the bookstore told me that they're going through a period of discussions, and this is going to be depressing, so get ready. Their group is asking the question, should we keep going around free, they work with dogs on chains. Should we keep sneaking into backyards and freeing chained dogs when the human who owns that house and owns that dog is just going to get another dog?
Mm.
Say you have a dog who's been living on a chain for 3 years, and that's its life, and it's out there all the time. There's no shelter. That's it. And all the things that are going wrong with this dog's body from being exposed, should you go and kidnap that dog when it means it's almost guaranteed that the human is going to go to the pound, get another dog, and put another dog on the chain? So what do you do with that? And what they're doing right now is to not do the kidnapping. And by the way, everybody I've talked to about this, dogs never resist their kidnappers.
Wow.
Dogs lick the faces of their kidnappers. So what they're doing is they're going to visit. They make visits to the dog that's on the chain. They
right.
go and make visits. And they bring blankets. They bring a dog bed. They bring stuff, which the owners, that from what I've heard, the humans are accepting of. And so they make visits rather than doing the kidnapping.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, the reader of your novel, The Mountaintop School for Dogs and Other Second Chances, will learn a whole lot about that and other forms of abuse, some that, you know, we may do unthinkingly, not knowing that they are actually abusive. It's a very thought-provoking book, and I want to thank you, Ellen Cooney, for talking with us here.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That was Ellen Cooney. You can read an excerpt from The Mountaintop School for Dogs by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we replay my interview from earlier this year with Vint Verga about his book, The Soul of All Living Creatures. Stay tuned after the break.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night, I should be sleeping like a log. But when I get them to you, I find the things that I do, you'll make me feel alright. You know I work all day
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Keeping in the spirit of today's show about the relationships between humans and animals, let's listen back to my interview with animal behaviorist Vint Verga about his award-winning book, The Soul of All Living Creatures, What Animals Can Teach Us About Being Human. We first aired it in early October. We love our cats and dogs and thrill to the sight of wild animals, whether they cross the road in front of us or dash across our electronic screens. But we tend to forget that we are animals ourselves and thus share our fragile planet with what are really our cousins in the animal kingdom. My guest, veterinary behaviorist Vint Verga, says that other animals have much to teach us about being human, not just the biological traits we share, but also other qualities like resilience, compassion, and being present in the moment. Verga draws on his 25 years of working with both domestic pets and zoo animals to explore these themes in his thoughtful and moving book, The Soul of All Living Creatures. Verga has appeared as a featured guest on ABC World News, PBS Nature, and National Geographic Explorer. He's one of only 61 behavioral veterinarians in the U.S. The Soul of All Living Creatures won a Nautilus Book Award in 2014. Vint Verga, welcome to Writer's Voice. I just loved this book, The Soul of All Living Creatures. What animals can teach us about being human. You know, it's interesting. I think humans reflexively, we tend to see ourselves as somehow not animals, although we are.
Yes, isn't it funny how we tend to separate ourselves from other living beings?
Yeah. And it seemed to me that this book really brings home that awareness of not only what animals can teach us about being human, but what animals can also teach us about being animals.
Yes, certainly. I think it's curious how we as humans somehow feel like we need to separate ourselves and distinguish ourselves from the natural world. Certainly, biologically, we are animals. But with all my work with animals in zoos and with family pets, it's very clear to me from 30 years of work that we share so much in common with the other animals with which we share the planet.
You know, people even have long denied, including scientists, have denied that animals have emotions, much less souls.
Well, it's been this struggle, I think, that we've gone back and forth through the ages. And I think in the past century, particularly in the last 60, 70 years, as science has become so objective that what the basic premise of most research is you have to prove something for it to be believed. So much of what we know about our commonalities with animals, so much of what we sense about our relationship with them, is challenging to measure objectively. With data. So if you can't prove it objectively with data, the presumption of science is it doesn't exist, which, of course, isn't necessarily true. Think of the atoms that make up our fingertips. 100 years ago, we didn't even know they existed, and yet they were there, and they've been there for thousands, well, since the beginning of our existence.
And it seems to be also kind of a denial of the basic fact of evolution that, you know, somehow we sprang into the world, you know, with completely novel things called emotions.
Yes, and science has, again, said, well, how do you measure an emotion? With people, the way we go about measuring emotions is that people report them to us. So even if we go to a doctor, a counselor, a social worker, and we try to work out our emotional issues, our feelings. We're at home talking with family members about our emotions. The way we convey them and really relate to each other about them is through words. Now, of course, we're speaking, but at the same time, conveying our emotions in plenty of other ways, visually, in terms of our body posture, facial expressions, eyes tearing up, lifting of an eyebrow, a glance in another direction. But also with, believe it or not, sense and tactile issues, the way we would go about touching another person, brushing against them, squeezing hard, hugging, holding ourselves at a distance, crossing our arms instead of reaching out and holding someone's hand. So we use these wealth of different ways of communicating that when it comes to actually objectively measuring them, it becomes, again, a lot more challenging. And for us to deny all the ways in which we relate to each other as human beings towards each other or towards other creatures and talk about it in strictly a scientific fashion, I think negates so much of who we are as beings, as human beings.
And you have really crossed that divide in your profession as a behavioral vet.
Yes, my expertise and specialization is in behavioral medicine. There's, I believe now, just over 61 veterinary behaviorists across the country. Some are in academics, some are in private practice. A good percentage are in private practice, advising and consulting with families that have concerns and issues with their dogs, cats, and other pets at home. And then I work primarily with zoo animals. Although I worked with companion animals in the past on behavioral issues, what has become very clear to me with the broad range of species with which I work with now is that the commonalities between us and them are so much greater than really the differences. And that brings us back to the opening of our conversation about how we really are animals, even though we are human too, of course.
So how have you used your experience in life and as a human being in your practice as a veterinary behaviorist?
It really goes both directions. Certainly as a human being, my experience of the world is very, very much is based on our human filters. But in my work day to day, it requires me to step out of my shoes and try to, as best I can, to step into the footsteps of an animal, to try to better understand the world as they perceive it. If we look at just even consider our dogs or cats, their sense of smell exceeds that of ours tremendously, or the range, the smells that they can pick up on, the distance at which they can pick up on those smells, even picking up on a few molecules of a scent. Their sense of hearing is very different from ours. Even their visual range, the colors which they do see, of which neither see the world in black and white, but they do see it in a different spectrum than we do, all give them a very different experience and perception of the world. Not worse, not better, just different. And to think that we have the best viewpoint, of course, is being anthropocentric, which is being very human-focused, where the world revolves around us as a species. But we know that isn't true. We know that the world is, even if we were completely eliminated from the planet overnight, the planet would keep on spinning and other animals would, of course, continue on in their existence. Considering we're all on this globe together, I think that it behooves us to try very much to step into an animal's shoes. So my job is to try to take what I've learned from science and from experience of working with such a broad range of species for several decades and try to assimilate that into what I know as a human being. Of course, it goes the other way around, that because of who we are as humans and our ability to think and process things in a different way than other creatures, it also helps for us to then try to sieve through what we can perceive of the world from them and apply it to our own existence.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with veterinary behaviorist Vint Verga about his wonderful book, The Soul of All Living Creatures. You have many, many stories in this book, both of zoo animals and domestic animals. You start with the story of Pongo, a dog who changed your life. Tell us that story.
Pongo really did, in all honesty, change the direction of my career to what it is today. I think he was the dog that really brought me to question everything I knew about animals and my relationship with them up to that point in my life. I was 4 years out of vet school. I was working in the Willamette Valley in Oregon as an emergency room vet. And it was, as I remember, a pretty bitter, stormy November night. The waiting room was filled with a variety of patients, from possums to dogs to cats. Pongo was a two-year-old flat-coated retriever that had been hit by a pickup truck as it was passing by his home. And he was rushed into the clinic and whisked straight from the waiting room right back to the treatment room, which is the hub behind the scenes where we did our most intensive work, past the triage tech who was trying to decide the priority of who needed care first and most importantly. Obviously hit by a car, we needed to know what sort of condition he was in. And when I took a look at him back in the treatment room, what I saw was a dog that was in very critical condition. His gums were an ashen gray pink. His breathing was very labored. When I tried to feel his pulse, I could just feel the faintest flutter underneath my thumb. And I knew he wasn't long for this world. We did an array of diagnostic tests as quickly as we could, x-rays and blood work and so forth. And everything that came back on Pongo seemed to be normal. He didn't seem to be this horribly, critically ill patient. And yet what I saw was very different from what any x-rays and lab work were showing us. We, of course, put him into intensive care, tried our best to get him stabilized. And once that was all done, with my waiting room still of patients, I started working back on the other patients and checking on Pongo through the night. It wasn't until about 2 or 3 a.m. That I was able to spend a good amount of time again with Pongo, more than just 5 minutes or so at a time. And at that time, when I checked on him, if anything, his condition had worsened. And at that point also, that late in the night, I surrendered, frankly, to my exhaustion and sank to the floor next to him and sat next to him and shared the blanket with him while I worked on my medical records, not knowing what else to do for him as a doctor. In that hour, something transformative happened with Pongo, where at first he was entirely non-responsive to anything that happened around him, my touch, my voice, anything. Within that hour, he started shifting in his body, leaning a little closer to me. The tip of his tail started to wag. And by the end of an hour, he was actually nuzzled into my lap in responding to everything I was doing. Nothing had changed in that hour with Pongo from all the other hours we'd spent in intensive care with him, except for that 1 hour of sitting with him, being connected, showing that someone cared. And it was then that I realized that in spite of all my medical skills and knowledge as a doctor, the most important thing to many of my patients that I can offer them is simply love and caring.
And that in itself was healing.
It was healing to him, and I feel to me, too, in that it gave me an entirely new insight and direction in which to focus my career as a doctor.
Mm. And so you became a veterinary behaviorist. You're working also with zoo animals. And I think, you know, I remember back when zoos were basically concentration camps for animals. I have to tell a little story here because I think it was maybe not as profoundly transformative as the story of Pongo, but it really taught me something about animals. I was in the Central Park Zoo when it was still a place where all the animals were in small cages. And there was, I think, a chimpanzee there, and I turned away. I'd been looking at him for a while, and I turned away. And all of a sudden, I felt something wet at the back of my neck. And he had thrown some of his feces at me.
Mm.
And I remember thinking back then, I just got that this was both a way for him to say, hey, I'm here and I'm a real person in here. And also to communicate some of the rage and anger that he felt at the position that he was in. Of course, maybe I'm just putting emotions into his head. But it was the first thing that made me to start thinking about, wait, if I were in his position, I'd be doing exactly the same thing. So you're working with zoos that are now very different. Talk about some of the ways in which zoos have evolved to deal with the emotional distress of animals.
Yes, well, I, like you, when I was younger, even into my 20s, tended to avoid zoos avidly because of the images that would haunt me after visiting them. Certainly not every animal in every habitat. Back then, they were called exhibits, which even there shows a mentality that animals are on exhibit for people to watch and be entertained by. What I felt as I focused my career in veterinary behavior and as I got older is that as much as I can be in resistance to zoos, I felt a higher calling, and that was there's still going to be animals regardless of whatever happens in a zoo that need caring, medical attention, behavioral support, but also an advocate for ensuring and improving their overall well-being and health. And I decided in my late 20s, early 30s, that what I wanted to do instead was work within the system of zoos to try to improve the quality of the animals' lives that are in zoos right now. At the same time, zoos have been dramatically evolving, particularly since the 70s. And nowadays, we don't talk about exhibits. Instead, we talk about habitats. And it isn't just a jargon. It's a matter of realizing that what we're trying to do is create a simulated world where we can provide these animals the highest quality of life possible. So the mission of zoos, where it once was entertainment, has become really a multi-pronged, and entertainment, while it will always be there, is relatively a lesser factor, I think, in terms of the priorities of any zoo I work with. Their ultimate priority is, I think, the animal care and well-being of those that are currently in their care. Also, though, the other focuses of the zoos around the country that I work with are their commitment to wildlife conservation for the animals that aren't in zoos, so that we aren't as dependent upon those animals that are in zoos for sustaining and keeping the gene pool of those species healthy and ongoing for future generations. But also education is just as important as conservation. And it's interesting because if we didn't have zoos, people would not be nearly as educated about the animals around them. We can watch a TV show about animals, but it's very different to go up and stand and watch a giraffe or an elephant or a zebra for even 5 minutes. It's a very different experience than just watching a narrated or even quiet, non-narrated picture on a TV or movie screen. So to experience animals firsthand is a very important part of our education of them as a species. But it also gives us something else. It gives us a chance to actually feel that connection that we do share with them, that we can't feel or experience unless we do so firsthand.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with veterinary behaviorist Vint Verga about his wonderful book, The Soul of All Living Creatures. And you are there to make that connection and to preserve the mental health of the animals that are there so that they can be more comfortable. Tell us the story of the ocelot. I don't remember his name, but there were two of them. One adapted fairly well, the other one not so much.
Yeah, the ocelots that I worked with at one zoo were Yaku and Tika, and they were approximately the same age. They lived in a really nice ocelot exhibit with a river and pond running through it, or a brook, I guess I should say, and a pond running through it. They had a varied terrain from some open area down near the water to what was basically a lush jungle habitat. It was a decent size, and it gave the cats an opportunity to experience a variety of terrains, an opportunity to interact with their keepers, and enrichment that was provided to them in different places every day. It gave an opportunity for the public to see them, but it also afforded both Yaku and Tika an opportunity to have their own privacy, so that if they chose at any time not to be visible to the public, they also had that ability to control their environment. And Tika used the full range of her world each and every day. She would climb the trees, ocelots being capable of being fairly arboreal. And she also would spend part of her day down by the pond and the brook and so forth. Yaku, on the other hand, would tend to hide away, oftentimes in the back holding quarters, which is basically the area that they can stay when the keepers need to go into their habitat and clean it up and tidy it up for them and provide them with new enrichment. And he would also hang out in the furthermost reaches of the habitat where people couldn't see them. I spent over two, almost 3 years with Yaku trying to figure out what the problem was in terms of what about his world was keeping him more secluded and reclusive. Part of it is his personality. Some of us are a lot more open and adaptable to environments than other of us, and that's true with any species, including cats and ocelots. But a good part of it, I think, was there was something in his environment that I was never able to fully get a grasp on, that to him was not ideal, that was a little bit aversive. We did help him over the course of 2 to 3 years, where he'd spend, I would say, roughly about 30 to 40% of his days more reclusive, but then the other 60 to 70% of the time, he was much more out there in his world and sharing the habitat fully with Tika.
What are some of the ways that you used to do this? I mean, you made his environment interesting, as was one of them.
Yeah. And certainly his environment was interesting in the first place. As I said, it was pretty rich in terms of habitat and opportunities for investigation and exploring. But what we did do is we made the most enticing, interesting, engaging parts of his world more towards the areas that he seemed to be avoidant of. And what he learned over time was that there were nice aspects of that world that were only afforded up front. So some of the most pleasant experiences he had started to become associated with being up front. So it wasn't this aversive or undesirable place to be in this world. This may all sound really questionable in terms of, well, what about the quality of Yaku's life and what about the quality of his environment if there was something about it he didn't like? But we all live in our world where there's parts of our world that we like and we don't like. Every day when I drive to and from Providence to pick my daughter up or take her to school, there's certain parts of the route that I would just as soon not have to drive through if I could. There's certain parts of our homes, our environments that all of us like more than others. There's trade-offs that many of us make in terms of whether we want to become city dwellers, for example. Maybe some of us aren't particularly city folks, but on the other hand, the benefits, the quality of our life, the opportunities for our enrichment, whether it be cultural, social, or even economic, are sometimes better in cities, and we make these trade-offs. The reality is that animals, even outside of zoos, no longer in many parts of the world live in pristine habitats. Human beings are encroaching upon their world with climate change, pollution, hunting, poaching, habitat loss. And it's sad to say, but the real state of affairs is that there are a growing number of species that I think are dramatically compromised out there in the real world to a degree that it concerns me as much as any animals in their habitat at a zoo.
Yeah. I mean, we're living through an era of wholesale extinction, in fact.
Yes, and to me, it's easy to become overwhelmed and devastated at the prospects with which we're offering future generations, and what we're the torch that we're handing over to our children is so much dimmer than what it could be. And the reality is, unless we change dramatically our focus, this generation, you and I, in the next 50 years, the reality is that our children and our children's children are going to be experiencing such a dramatically compromised world to the one we currently live in.
And I think that's one of the underlying messages of your wonderful book, Vinverga, The Soul of All Living Creatures, that we must understand our connection. We must understand the importance of the other animals to us, because that is a way to make the emotional connection that can help us swear to preserve our world.
Yes, very much so. That is the an underlying intention in the book, is to help us to realize that our perspective in the world, while it's benefited us tremendously as a species through the centuries, also is at this point detaching us and separating us from the realities of our world. The truth is that as humans, most of us go about our days so much focused on past and future, and very much not living in the present moment. The Buddhist principles say, you know, now is the moment, now is the moment, now is the moment. And if we are always thinking about other than what we are currently presented with, it's easy to dismiss reality for all of our goals and plans and agendas and intentions. The truth is that the animals in our world could not survive in the world if they lived detached from the present moment. They'd end up hit by cars or prey to other species, or not adapting to their environment, not shifting to their range with habitat loss. And so they, by evolution, are always focused on living in the present moment. So the lessons animals can offer us about awareness, a mindfulness to the moment, presence, and their sensitivity to the cues and signals around them rather than dismissing them or ignoring them, how they go about expressing themselves, their attention to more than just words, but to also to sense, smells, visual signals, all can serve as reminders about, while we're human, we also are animals, and it would behoove us, in terms of what we want to leave to our families and our children, to think about walking in the world more in tune and in step with all that is around us.
I just love this book, The Soul of All Living Creatures, What Animals Can Teach Us About Being Human. Thank you so much, Dr. Verga, for talking with us here.
Thanks for asking me to join you.
Veterinarian Vinverga. As a veterinary behaviorist, he works primarily with zoo animals. You can read an excerpt from The Soul of All Living Creatures at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.